Hello, and welcome to Sobercast, where we provide AA speaker meetings and workshops in podcast format. We're an ad-free podcast, and if you enjoy listening, please help us be self-supporting by visiting Sobercast.com, look for the donate link, and drop a dollar or two into our virtual basket. We hope you enjoy the podcast. Have a great day.
Hi, my name is Bob. I'm an alcoholic. I'm glad to be here. I want to thank, first of all, Cindy for the invitation, and Liz for all the hospitality. And whatever. It's always a pleasure for me to participate in the meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. I think it's a little more meaningful when there's some new people, or comparatively new people. Because whether you new people realize this or not, and I'm sure you don't, because we didn't. Fact of life. Next to us old timers, you're the second most important people in the room tonight. Don't ever forget it. But really, without you new people, this thing would probably end up with all us old-timers sitting around here telling these same old stories. We'd probably all get drunk, you know. I'm what this book says is a real alcoholic. In fact, I'm one of them bar-drinking drunks. Are there any bar drinkers here tonight? Thank God. I mean, I don't know where the rest of you did your thing, but I'll tell you this. If you didn't get some bar time in, you missed a lot of fun. I loved everything about those joints, you know. I loved everything that goes on in there. I like the smell in there. I like them stools you can spin around on. I like them mirrors that they got in places. You know, fact of life. Cindy and I could go out here tomorrow, open up a joint without a mirror. Fact of life, we'd go broke in 2 weeks. Yeah. Three things you have to have in this country in order to operate a bar successfully. One, you got to have the booze. Second, you got to have a license to sell it. And third, you got to have a mirror. Or you will not make it in the bar business. That mirror, incidentally, is not there for social drinkers. Bars cannot survive on social drinkers. They depend on people who drink in volume. And you and I are the volume drinkers of this world. Social drinkers do weird stuff in bars. You bar drinkers know what I'm talking about. I mean, they come in there, they have a couple drinky poos. And then they start saying weird off the wall kind of crap, like, ooh, I'm getting dizzy, I'm going home. Going home? People like you and I, we sit there all day. And we have to have something to entertain ourselves, and it's usually our own image, thus the mirror. Yeah, we sit there all day staring in the mirror, you know, figuring things out, you know. I like them jukeboxes they have in joints. You know, the ones that play Born to Lose all day. I even got to like the man's John in them places. When I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, we used to have a guy in Southern California and known nationally by the name of Norm Alpe, God rest his soul, who was a bar drinking drunk. And the first time I heard him, he was up at one of these podiums, and he talked fast. I mean, he's the only man up till today in Alcoholics Anonymous can give a one-hour talk in 32 minutes, or did give a talk in 32 minutes. I mean, he'd really shoot it out, and you had to listen close to catch it. And he's up there this night, and first time I ever heard him, and he's ranting and raving and going on, and all of a sudden he said something weird that got my attention. He said he got to be a bathroom slider in a men's john. And right away, one of the bananas fell out of my ears, and I thought, what is this clown talking about? You know, because I thought I'd done it all by the time I got to Alcoholics Anonymous. I don't know about you. And here's this guy talking about something completely foreign to me. And I thought, you know, what's he talking about? And he went on to explain that bathroom sliders in the men's john, I think in the ladies too, where they have those pay toilets. Good, keen, smart alcoholics slide under the door to avoid paying. Save that money for drinking whiskey. Right away I thought, by God, why didn't I think of that? Bet you there's a couple thinking it right now. Then he went on to explain that whenever he got done doing what he was doing in there, he'd slide back out. Never realized, of course, that once you're in there, you can turn the handle and walk out. And anybody that thinks like that is a friend of mine. And so I'm eternally grateful to Norm Albies and the Eddie Regans and Chuck Chamberlains and Jimmy Ryans, and I'm sure the people that you know when you first came to Alcoholics Anonymous, who said things from podiums like this to drunks like me. And I'm eternally grateful. I can't explain it, but I identified. I identified when they were talking. And I thought to myself, my God, I did that too. And another one would get up there and I'd say, I did that too. And all of a sudden I came to the conclusion, if you did all that stuff and they're alcoholic, you're obviously alcoholic. And so it was quite a revelation. When I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, are there any Texans here tonight? No Texans. That's rare. They move around a lot, you know. But the reason, you said something that really triggered something. She says, just in California. You wonder why all the speakers, a lot of the speakers and a lot of the people that are odd and stuff like that end up in California. It's very self-explanatory. If you ever look at the globe of the world, you'll notice that the United States is kind of tilted like this to the southwest, and everything loose rolls there. But when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, we didn't have a lot of speaker meetings at first, and a lot of things have changed in Alcoholics Anonymous. And one of the early things that really happened was one of our members was the governor of Iowa. And I got to know him on a personal basis. And then he ran for the United States Senate, and he won. And he became a United States Senator. And it was his intent at that time to put some federal money into the field of alcoholism. And he did. And I don't know if he did us a big favor or he did us an injustice. The story's really not complete yet. But anyway, it started a lot of alcohol programs throughout the United States, in hospitals and various and sundry institutions. And it got the medical profession into the field of alcoholism. And even today, we have in the medical profession two different schools of thought about alcoholism. Some think it's hereditary. Some think you acquire it. And I don't know. I'm not an authority on alcoholism. I'm just a recovered drunk. But if there's anything to this thing about being hereditary, I might qualify. My great-grandfather was an alcoholic. My grandfather was an alcoholic. My dad and his two brothers are alcoholics. My oldest brother is a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. My son just got a 30-day chip in Alcoholics Anonymous. Along with his wife. My daughter had a lot of... She's a winette. That's what they call a female wino. And a pill head. And she came to Alcoholics Anonymous, and today she doesn't find it necessary to go to AA meetings, but she loves Alcoholics Anonymous and whatever. So, and that would almost indicate that this thing might be hereditary in my family. But then there's my middle brother. He's a social drinker, and I watch him like a hawk. I mean, whatever that is, a social drinker. But I watch him. And once a year, we have a family gathering. He lives in San Francisco. I live in Glendale, California. And once a year, we have a little gathering at my house in the desert. And he likes to drink Old Fitz on the rocks. And so I always have a bottle up in the cupboard when he comes. And then I watch, see what's going to happen. And he comes in my house, goes in my cupboard, gets that bottle of this Old Fitz out of the cupboard, picks up a big glass, which is a big tip-off to me, and he fills it full of ice. And then he does this deal, you know. He takes this bottle, he spritzes around like this, big deal. And then he takes that glass of whiskey and goes in my living room, sits down on my couch, takes that glass of whiskey, puts it on my end table, picks up a book and starts to read. I tell him, for God's sake, man, drink it! You know what he does? He sits there for 3 hours sipping and reading. I have to leave the house. I cannot stand it. I don't know how anybody can do that. There are no sippers in Alcoholics Anonymous. We're all gulpers. We don't sip nothing. We don't sip water. We just whoop down. Soda pop. We whoop, pour it down. Normsies look at us and say, did you drink that all already? You don't understand. Conversely, he don't understand when I was drinking how I make a pig of myself, you know. And once in a while, when I was drinking, I would get into some financial problems. I'm sure it never happened to anybody here. And once in a while, I would have to call him and put the touch on him, help me out of some jackpot, financial jackpot. And invariably, he would send it. About 2 weeks after he sent the money, and I got out of this problem that I'm in, he'd call and say weird things to me that norms he'd say to alcoholics. He'd say, I heard you're drinking again. Now, how does he know that? He lives in San Francisco. I live in Glendale. How the heck does he know that? But I got that figured out now. It was my mother. She lives in Wisconsin, 2,000 miles away. But she can smell whiskey on me 2,000 miles away. And she'd call Dick and say, Bob's drinking again. And then he'd call and ask the stupid questions that norms he'd ask alcoholics. Why didn't you do something about it? Why didn't you just quit? You know, just quit. My God. It was the thing that was holding me together, I thought. And so, I guess it's important that also that, you know, I look back at this and I think, why my oldest brother and why me and why my dad and all the family? Why not him? Why not him? And then I get to, you know, I'm getting up in years now and I start to thinking about how this all came about in my life, you know. I'm sure you all have done that. And I've come to some conclusions. They're my conclusions and I'm stuck with them. But I've come to these conclusions that the day I was born, I had two strikes against me right out of the chute, you know. First strike was I was born in this little town in Wisconsin. And you all know how little towns are. Everybody knows everybody's business. And sometimes that's good, and sometimes it's bad. In my case, it seemed always bad. And the second strike against me was my dad was assistant chief of police in that damn town. He's about 6'4", weighed 280 pounds, wore a uniform, carried a gun, scared the living bejesus out of you. And for the first 15 years of my life, I did everything that that turkey told me to do, out of fear. Because I knew deep down inside, if he ever hit me, he'd kill me. You know, he's a big moose and a tough cop, and I'm scared to death of him. I mean, little things. If he told me to run to the store, I literally ran to the store. You know, I didn't slow down when I got out of sight or something, you know. And I'd run all the way back. If he told me to carry out the trash, I carried out everything that even looked like trash, you know. If he told me to rake the leaves, I even raked the neighbor's leaves. And in Wisconsin, they have a lot of snow. And he explained quite well to me, if 5 flakes of snow fell on our sidewalk, it was my job to take it off of there. And I did it religiously out of fear until this magical thing that happens to all human beings happened. About the age of 15, something happens to human beings. Medical science can't explain it. You know that it happened to you, and I know that it happened to me. And I don't know how it happened to you, but I have this concept of how it happened to me. If you don't believe any of this, go out here tonight, find a 15-year-old. Ask him or her a question on any subject in the world, and they'll tell you. The smartest thing walking the face of the earth right this minute is a 15-year-old. In their humble opinion. And you were no different, and I was no different. And like I say, I don't know how it happened to you, but I have this concept of that it came floating on a cloud in my bedroom at night and went kaboom. And no bells or whistles went off, but I knew the next morning something was different, you know? I got up that morning, got dressed, went downstairs and had breakfast and headed off to school. No big deal, you know? Then I came home from school at noon for lunch, and it was snowing. and I know my job, right? But this thing, it happened in the night. I said, screw it, I just won't do it no more. My logic and reasoning was, what will the neighbor say? A genius out there shoveling snow, you know. Manual labor. All of a sudden, it's beneath my station in life. I just won't do it. And I took that snow shovel and set it up against the house and went in and said, the heck with him. I don't care what he does. I just won't do it. Sat down at the kitchen table, started to eat my lunch. Then I heard the squad car pull up in front. Then I heard the car door slam. Then I heard the shovel out there on the sidewalk. And I said to myself, it's about time he does something around here. Did you ever have the feeling like you got to do it all? That's the way I felt. And he came in the house all out of breath because he wasn't used to that manual labor. I'd been doing it all. Took off that uniform cap and that big heavy Mackinaw they wear in the winter and that sand brown belt and at 45 and laid it on the dining room table like he did every day. Came in the kitchen, sat down at the kitchen table right across from me. And then he threw me a curve. He didn't say a word. And if you've just been endowed with the smarts, that will drive you nuts. I'm just waiting for him to say something. I've been saving it up for 15 years. I'm going to lay it on him, and today's the day. And he didn't say a word. And I finished my lunch ahead of him, and I had to go back to school. I can remember this incident like it happened yesterday. Got up, walked around the kitchen table, had to go past him, out through the dining room, through the living room, out the front door, back to school. I can't explain this, neither. I'm sure you understand it. I just knew deep down inside, I could not let a situation like this go by without saying something. And I stopped right in front of him, looked him right in the eye, reached down inside and got one of them pearls of wisdom I'd just been endowed with, right? Looked him right in the eye, said the smartest thing I could think of. I said, is the snow heavy today? Big mistake. He didn't say a word again. He just kind of turned in the chair and came all the way from right field with a flat of the hand, direct hit. And I took off in the air up against the dining room windows. And when I came to, I developed another bad attitude. I said to myself and only to myself, nobody can hit me like that and get away with it. I'll get even with him, by God, if it kills me. And in the quiet of my room at night, I used to plan his demise. Now, I understand today that's not proper thinking for a 15-year-old to be planning his father's demise. Well, that's the way it really was. But another side to that, up until the moment he hit me, he's my big hero in life. The sun, moon, and stars set on him. And all he had to do was hit me once. And the only time he ever hit me, I hated his guts. And that's the real fact of it. And all these incidents I'm about to tell you, I believe has had an effect, probably still does, on my attitude towards people, places, and things. And by the time I got to the doors of Alcoholics Anonymous, my attitude towards people, places, and things really was messed up. About a year after that incident, another big deal happened. Another cold winter day in Wisconsin. Snow piled up as high as the ceiling. Three of my buddies and I come home from school about 4 in the afternoon, come down the street and get to the corner to go down to my house. And there, passed out in the snowbank in full uniform, is my dad, dead drunk. And these three buddies of mine started teasing me about my drunk dad, that drunk cop. And we went to Fist City right there, and I won. But I'll never forget the feelings and emotions I had that day. I realized then and there that he had disgraced that uniform he wore, disgraced that badge he wore, and lost the faith and trust of that community that he had pledged his life to protect and to serve. Big deal. About 8 months after that incident, another big deal happened. At the age of 47, he died of chronic alcoholism. Didn't say it on his death certificate. He's a big shot in that town. It said heart disease. But those of us who lived with him knew that the booze had gotten him. And then I found out another fact of life, that doctors, lie on death certificates to certain people in certain towns, and they're still doing it today. Fact of life. About a year after that incident, another big deal happened in my life. I was going with this gal. When I say we were going together, we started out in kindergarten together. Same Sunday school, same church, same grade school, same high school. Right out of high school, we got married. It was a beautiful event. Crossed white shotguns, everything. She never did like me to say that. I used to just say, well, it happens in the best regulated families. And that was the 12th of January, 1948. And on the 23rd of November, 2001, she was diagnosed with cancer. And on December 23rd, 2001, God came and took her from me. 3 weeks short of 54 years. And indeed, my life has changed. I'm like lost sheep. And sometimes, some days, I think my heart's going to break. Still today. And I really miss her. And I hate them damn dishes. And I don't like the laundry, neither. But the ironing seems to be the worst. I bet you I'm the only guy in this room that can get 3 creases in the front of a pants. I don't know how they do that. I'm having a hell of a time with it. But if you want some lessons, let me know. But suffice to say, it's just been an incredible shock. And I have to appreciate the fact that we had almost 54 years together and 39 of them sober. The reason I ask if there's any Texans, when you talk in Texas, if in the first 5 minutes of your talk you don't tell them your sobriety date, they automatically assume you don't have one. Texans are tough, you know. And so, in deference to any Texans, you know, my sobriety date is 13th of January, 1964. Which means last Monday I celebrated 39 years. And I didn't come here to get 39 years sober, you know. I don't know about you, but I came here to get all those people off my back. The bill collectors and that woman and those kids and that damn dog and the IRS. And if they'd just get off of my back, everything would be all right, you know? But I'm eternally grateful that the way life has turned out, maybe not for everything, but... And right after we were married, like all women, she started to demand things, like furniture to sit on it, curtains on the windows, and all that kind of stuff. And I don't have any money. And I go down and see my dad's buddy, the chief of police, and told the chief, you know, she wants all this stuff, and I don't have any money. He said, go up to the sheriff's department tomorrow. I think they need some help. And any of you who come from a small town, you know the process. One phone call is all it took. Walked into the sheriff's department the next morning, they pinned a gold badge on me. And I got to be a drunk cop, just like my dad. And time doesn't permit me to tell you what can happen to a drunk cop, except stir up some old resentments, and God knows you probably don't need any more, especially when it comes to cops. Bunch of cop haters right over here. I can spot them a mile away. But I'll tell you right now, if I could be anything in this world right this minute, it would still be a cop. I loved every minute of it. I loved all the excitement, the camaraderie, and everything that goes with being a cop. And I don't know what was going on in your life prior to entering Alcoholics Anonymous, but I'll tell you another fact of life. You know that 99 out of 100 human beings, that isn't only us, that's all those people out there. 99 out of 100 human beings have one thing in their life that's the single most important thing in their life. And in 99 out of 100 cases, that one single thing is another human being. Isn't it incredible? It's another human being. It's a wife, a husband, a lover, a child, a parent, a grandparent, aunts, uncles, somebody is the single most important thing in 99 out of 100 people's lives, except cops. If there's any cops here tonight, don't ask me, ask them. They all have one thing that's above all human things. It's a damn badge. And everybody that's ever carried one will tell you the same thing I'm about to tell you. I'd have done anything short of murder to keep that damn badge. Except stay away from one drink of whiskey. And this woman, she comes from a family that they don't have the problem, you know. She comes from one of them normsy families, whatever that is. I mean, they did weird stuff, I thought. They go to church on Sundays and picnics in the park and walks in the woods. I don't know anything about that stuff. And like I, she was totally void of anything about alcoholism. I mean, she didn't know anything about Alcoholics Anonymous, Al-Anon, Alateen, Alatot, none of that stuff. All she knew is she loved a drunk cop and it was driving her nuts. And I don't want any newcomers to think I got a bunch of warrants in my pocket and you start heading for the door, you know. I mean, they took that badge away from me a long time ago. And next to the night that my wife died, it was the second most devastating night of my life. Nothing I planned, because like I tell you, if I had my choice right this minute, I'd be out there riding in black and white. But it all came down one night, a bunch of cops and our wives going to have a party. And I don't think there's anything different, incidentally, between a cops party and a civilian party. Except maybe at the cops party, the booze is all free. And that's where drunks like me really shine. I don't know about any of you, but I just love free booze parties. And I'm not the kind of guy at a free booze party sitting over here in the corner sipping on drinks with a little pinky sticking out, you know. I'm back here in the kitchen where the supply is, with both hands, getting all I can get while they're getting good in case they run out, you know. And I don't know how long we were at that party, and she sidled up next to me in the kitchen and says, "We're leaving." I said, "What are you talking about, woman? We just got here." At least it seemed like that to me. I don't know about any of you, but every booze party I've ever been at in my life, it seemed to me there's a magic takes place in the room. And I'm part of the magic, and I'm not leaving. And she looked at me with them cold Al-Anon eyes and said, "We're leaving." And I don't know to this day how she got the keys. Because I'm like you, you know. It's my car I drive. I'm sure nobody here ever said that. And she had the keys, and we left. And all the way home, she started bad-mouthing me again about my drinking. This whole scenario, incidentally, is in the book. Newcomers, read the book. It talks about this whole scenario in the book. It says, "You and I, who are real alcoholics, go through life with blinders on us like they put on horses, and we don't see anything that way, and we don't see anything that way. It's our way or no way. We're very selfish individuals." And she's yakking at me about all these things. And every alcoholic I know, when people are telling us these god-awful truths, we have a switch here, and we shut it all off. I mean, it don't even hit the eardrum. It goes, chew, right over the top. And I can't explain that night when, on the way home, something happened. I don't know if the switch went back on or the blinders fell off, but for the first time in our married life, I started hearing some of this heavy-duty crap she's laying on me. I mean, she's starting to say things to me like, "Oh, my drinking is affecting our entire life," she said. I said, "What are you talking about?" She said, "First of all, it's affecting our social life." I said, "Yeah, how's that?" She said, "We just had to leave that party back there for one reason and one reason only." I said, "Yeah, what's that?" She said, "Because of your dirty, filthy mouth." I'm sure nobody here believes that either. And she said, "Not only that, it's affecting every other aspect of our life." And I said, "Now what are you talking about?" She said, "It's affecting our home life, our family life, our kids' lives, our financial life, our sex life. Everything about us is being affected by my drinking." Now I'm certain she flipped her lid or something. And we got out of the car and headed into the house and got in the house and she wouldn't shut up. And I reached for the only thing I know would shut her up, a 38. I said, "Woman, I've heard all I'm ever going to hear from you about my drinking. I'm going to blow your damn brains out." And she took off like a deer. Shoo! Out the front door of that house, 6 blocks down the street, to the only place she knew she could get help, right? The sheriff's office that I work at. And I'd have got her, too, if she'd just slowed down. And you'd have a different speaker here tonight, too. I'd be up in one of them joints, walking the yard, talking the talk, and walking the walk. And so I'm eternally grateful to something, call it any damn thing you want to, that I didn't pull that trigger that night. And I came out of that blackout standing in the middle of the sheriff's office at 3 o'clock in the morning with a 38 in my hand, going to kill somebody. and all the guys are coming off a late shift, and they're standing around the squad room, and they're all, you know, your family, friends, loved ones, fellow workers sometimes look at you when you're drunker than a skunk. They look down their nose at you like you're some kind of second-class citizen or something. I can't even describe it. But I'll tell you another fact of life. If you don't know what I'm talking about right this second, you do not belong here. Those people near and dear to us look at us really funny when we're drunker than a skunk. And they're all looking at me, and all of a sudden, the boss heard the ruckus down in the squad room. Now, the boss is the elected sheriff of that county and a great friend of my dad. So now you understand why I'm in the department. That's how it works. At least it did then. And he came in the squad room, looked at the guys coming off the late shift, and then he looked at me. And being a boss just recently of my own, of a large company, I realized then and there that he had to make a decision, management decision, right now. And he did what he had to do. He walked over to me, looked me right in the eye, and said, Bob, hand it over, the badge and the gun. And they took away my badge, my gun, and my uniform. And I had to go out there and face that world bare naked. Because that badge was a authority to me. I could show you that badge and make you do anything I want you. And I did a lot of things behind that badge that I'm not very proud of. And there's only one man in this world knows what I did. And he was my first sponsor, and he just passed away in 1997. But I did some bad stuff behind the badge, which I am eternally... I've tried to make the amends to some of them. Some of them I don't even know where they are. So my sponsor told me that you can't do anything about that. And so, at the age of 31, I did the most adult, mature thing I could think of. I ran away from home. If there's any runners here tonight, I want to talk to you outside after the meeting. But you know, wherever I go in this country or any other country, I find these rooms are full of runners. You know that? Running to something, running from something. And every runner who's ever come to Alcoholics Anonymous, including me, we all forgot one thing, and we all forgot the same identical thing. It's incredible. And that is, no matter where you're running to or running from, you forgot it, I forgot it. I had to bring me along, and you had to bring you along. And you is the problem, and me is the problem. And you can't make this thing alone, and I can't make this thing alone. But together we can make it. And that's the miracle it talks about in that book. One drunk talking to another, and it works. It works to the tune of over 2 million sober members of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I consider myself very privileged to be here. And also, over the years, I've had the privilege, and I mean a privilege, to eyeball 50% of them. Eyeball to eyeball. And I believe that's an earned privilege. It is not given. You earn the right to do this and suit up and show up and do what's asked of you in Alcoholics Anonymous and come all the way to Tacoma on a cold winter day. And took... I mean, it was 82 in my house yesterday. And I really appreciate the opportunity. And so I guess it's important we get on with this thing or some of the newcomers are going to get nervous, you know. They get nervous, they start watching the clock, you know. They're the same ones that used to sit in bars and say, what do you mean it's closing time? I have to tell you about my last drunk, because I've been here long enough to say this with authority. If you can't remember your last drunk, you probably haven't had it yet. And I don't know about any of you, but I never want to forget what was going on in my life the day I walked into Alcoholics Anonymous in utter desperation. And if you're new here tonight, we only wish you well here. And you won't get that out there. You won't get that out there on that street of broken dreams and broken promises. You won't get it. They won't give it to you. They don't give a damn if you live or die, incidentally. But we care whether you make it or not. And you'll find we love you in spite of yourself. We'll love you. And I'm eternally grateful for the people who showed me a little caring and sharing. They literally saved my life. But my last drunk was no big deal. I didn't sit around and plan it for 3 weeks or something. You know, it just happened. It was a Friday night, 27th of December, 1963. Just finished eating dinner. Made the big announcement to that woman and those kids. Told them I'm going out and have a couple of beers with the guys. I'll be back in 2 hours. And she started that yak, 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 you know. The Al-Anon doesn't know what I'm talking about. And I said, listen, woman, I want to tell you something for the last time. I just put in 40 for a bunch of ingrates around here. And I'm going out there and commiserate with my friends, and I'll be back in 2 hours. Now, knock it off. And it was the 27th of December, 1963, at about 7 in the evening. And I got back on the 13th of January, 1964. Can't tell you to this day where the hell I was. I know on the 27th of December, 1963, at about 7:30, I went to my favorite watering hole. It was a place called the Prelude. Now, isn't that a nice name for a dump? You know? It has the connotation you're only going to be there for a little bit, you know? The Prelude on Lancashire Boulevard in North Hollywood, which really isn't a lot to shoot for. It was one of those padded sewers I'd been starting to frequent. You know the kind I'm talking about? They didn't even have a front door, you know, just curtains hanging there. And I really went there to meet these lifelong drinking buddies of mine who I just met 2 weeks ago. And sure enough, they were all there. And we started doing the things that real drunks do in bars. It's happening right now in Tacoma. Standing around here talking in millions and spending in dimes. Trying to impress people we don't know with money we don't have. If you're a smart drunk like me, you're trying to put the make on some dolly down there at the end of the bar and impress the heck out of them. And you know what? In this group of six guys, fact of life, there wasn't one common laborer in the whole bunch. We were all brain surgeons and jet pilots and astronauts and doctors and lawyers and devout liars. But in this group of six guys was a new guy. His name was Pete. And Pete was one of those intellectual giants you meet in bars. You bar drinkers again know who I'm talking about. That's the guy or gal who sits down at the end of the bar and has the answer to every living subject in the world. And they drive people like you and I nuts. And that was Pete. I mean, if you had marital problems and I had marital problems, he had the answers. If you had legal problems, he had the answers. If you had medical problems, he had the answers. If you had engineering problems, he had the answers. I thought he was the greatest thing since sliced bread, you know? I thought, how can one guy know so much about so many things? And he continued that drunk with us, and thank God he did, because as it turned out, Pete was really quite the guy. He was the one guy in the group who, it seemed, was always well enough to make the run for the rest of us who were too sick to make the run. Pete could find a jug on election day in a dry state, you know, one of those great guys. And besides that, he had A negative blood, and I stuck pretty close to him. I just lost half a room. You know how I know that? No matter where I go in this country or any other country, by the time I hit the parking lot out here, three people at least are going to tap me on the shoulder, ask me the same damn question the world over. They all tap you on the shoulder and says, hey, man, I want to ask you something. I said, yeah, what do you want now? What do you mean by that A negative blood crap? Just so we don't plug up the parking lot here tonight, I'll tell you ahead of time. First of all, if you have A negative blood, it's rare blood. And second of all, when you're selling it to buy wine, you get more for A negative than any other kind of blood. So I stuck close to Pete, you know. I mean, I might have been born at night, but not last night. And then I can't tell you the serious events that happened because I was passing in and passing out. And we were living in these abandoned cars, one of which was mine. You laugh. You know how your car gets to be an abandoned car? That's kind of a work of art. The tires are usually flat, the battery's dead, it's out of gas, and it's usually 6 months behind in payments. Then legally, it's an abandoned car. It also got to be our living room, our kitchen, our bedroom, and our bathroom. Got a little salty in there. And one of those mornings, I can't tell you which one, we all came to and Pete didn't. And he had swallowed his tongue that night in a convulsion. and he was deader than a doornail. And I got fighting mad at everything and everybody. And God, if there is a God, because my great intellect and better judgment took over again, which incidentally got you here and get me here. My great intellect and better judgment took over, and I said to myself, self, if there's a God, why would he let a good guy like Pete go, who knows everything there is to know about everything, and let me stay? And then I can't tell you the series of events that happened after Pete was gone. But this is what I never forget, as long as I live. Early morning on the 13th of January, 1964, some phenomena started taking place. I don't even know what the hell a phenomena is, but some weird stuff started happening. Because all of a sudden, out of that radio, came the most beautiful music I ever heard in my life. It was like the Boston Philharmonic Orchestra was in the car with us. And I know today it was hallucinations because the battery was dead, you know? But it's as real as I'm standing here. And then I thought, man, this is how it must be when you die. And whether you believe this or not, everybody sitting here tonight, I'll have a little tape up here that you conjured up and that I conjured up about your concept and my concept of what it's going to be like when we check out. And every one of them is different. And mine had something to do with music being played, and here was the music. And then I got scared. Have you ever been real scared? I mean really, really scared. I thought cops aren't supposed to get scared. But I got real scared. And for the first time in my adult life, I got down on my knees in that sewer, cried out to a God I was absolutely certain did not exist. And if he did exist, he didn't want anything to do with a drunk like me. But I said the most honest, sincere prayer I've ever uttered in my life. I said, God, if there be a God, the only prayer I know is help me. And through a series of unexplained happenings, which I believe are miracles, one of which was that morning, my wife worked at Warner Brothers Studios. And she was in the secretary pool that morning, and I'd been gone 18 days. And she was sitting at her desk crying. And one of the big bosses came walking through the secretary pool that morning, tapped her on the shoulder and said, you better do that here in my office. And she went into his office, and she told him for the first time in her entire career at Warner Brothers that she was living with this drunk. And he's been gone, and she's saved up enough money, and today is the day she's leaving. And he said, why don't you have him try Alcoholics Anonymous? And she said, how do you know? And he said, because I are one. And that was the first time in his 37 years at the studio he broke his anonymity that morning to help one sick alcoholic, me. And I'm eternally grateful. And I got to go to my first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous that night. And it hasn't been necessary since. There's got to be a phony, a cheat, a liar, and a con. If you don't know what a con is, you're looking at one. But I did spot a couple more in here tonight. I'm glad all you con artists are here. I don't know about you, but I got really good at it, you know. I could con you out of your socks and you wouldn't even know it. I think I could do it again with a couple weeks' practice. And I just incredible. And I got directed to one of these AA clubhouses, and I'm not here to promote them either, because some of them I've seen in this country and other countries are dens of iniquity. But the one I went to was not, is not, will not be, as long as I got anything to do with it. And I walked in the door that morning like that, and there's two guys sitting over here playing cribbage like at a round table like this. And they watched me as I came in the door, and they stopped playing cribbage. And one of them poked the other one and says, we better do something with that one, or he's going to start jackknifing around the room here, you know. I mean, I wasn't nervous, just quick, you know. And they applied the only therapy they knew at that time. Did you hear that? The only therapy that they knew at that time. They gave me a bucket of paint and a paintbrush, figuring that I could paint faster than anybody else in the place. And I painted that damn clubhouse, and I don't know today how long I painted. I don't know if it was 5 days, 50 days. I don't think it means a heck of a lot. But I'll never forget the day I finished. It was a bright Saturday morning like today. Put away the buckets and the brushes and cleaned everything up just perfect, because we're perfectionists too, you know. And then I found out the truth that one of them cribbage players had been a painter all his life. And that old thinking came back that fast. Why me, God? Why wasn't he up there painting? And I'll fix their clocks. I'll get drunk at every damn one of these phonies. And headed out the back door of that clubhouse, bound and determined to quit Alcoholics Anonymous, get drunk at every damn one of you. And then God, as I understand God, had to perform another miracle, and he had to do it damn fast because I was going. And you know what? I reached for the push bar and let a door like that. Reached for that push bar on the back door of that clubhouse, and the door opened up ahead of me, and there's this clown standing on the landing out there, and he says, "Hi!" And I said, "Shove it!" He says, "Why you say that to me? I don't even know you." I said, "Shove it anyhow." He said, "Come here, I want to talk to you." Brought me in the meeting hall and set me down in them Henroy chairs. I'm glad you got them here. Them cold metal ones, not these nice padded ones they have today. Them cold metal chairs, Henroy chairs. And I told them about them gray-haired goats, and they made me paint that club, and I'm going to get drunk at every one of them. He said, and he got to be my sponsor. He said, "If I'm going to be your sponsor, three things are going to happen to you, man. One, you're going to go to meetings. Two, you're going to study that book. And three, for the first time in your adult life, you're going to follow instructions." So how the heck does he know that? And we went to meetings. He took me to meetings when I didn't want to go to meetings. And newcomers, it's going to happen to you because it's happened to every one of us, so don't feel bad about it. You're going to say to your wife, your husband, your buddy, your girlfriend, "Meetings, meetings every night. Tonight I'm not going." And that night he came by early. Put me in the car and started down the freeway. I said, "Where are we going tonight?" He said, "We're going to the hole in the ground." And I thought, "Oh my God, now they're going to bury me." And I know you don't know where the hole in the ground is, but it's a club like that, and started by a guy by the name of Tex Adams, who'd been sober since Lincoln had the measles. And thank God for people like Tex who started places like that for drunks like me. And he told me I had to study that book. He would not let up, you know? He'd get that book in his hand and get me over in the corner and he'd start pounding at the book and he'd say weird stuff, I thought to me. He'd say between page one, he's a crusty old bugger too, between page one and 164 of this book, it's how drunks like him and millions of others before him had found a way of not to die from chronic alcoholism. Then he'd look me right in the eye and say, "If you don't want to do it, then get the heck away from me." I thought, how can he talk to a sick alcoholic like that? Don't he understand we're sensitive? And he literally saved my life. He motivated me to do the one thing I would never have done on my own volition. I cracked the cover of the book, and it found me in there. We got to Huntington Park that night and started down the steps into the Evo Club. And another unexplained happening happened. I can't explain it. I think it started all the way from the toes. I know today it was my first honest feeling. And I tapped him on the shoulder, and I said, "Joe, I got to ask you something." He turned around and said, "Yeah? What do you want now?" And I knew that second he had had me up to here. He was sick and tired of my BS, and I knew it. And I asked him that world-famous question that all newcomers are compelled to ask their sponsor. "How long do I have to go to these damn meetings?" And this wise old man with the X-ray vision got fighting mad that fast. Took his index finger and shoved me into the corner outside the meeting hall so they wouldn't hear it inside. When he got me in the corner where I couldn't get away, he started to get violent. Yeah. He started to hit me in the chest like this, and he started to scream. I can hear it yet today. He said, "You idiot!" I didn't like that. He said, "You have to go to meetings until you want to go to meetings. Then you don't have to go to meetings anymore." Didn't make much sense then, but it sure does now. But that night, because he hit me in the chest and screamed at me, "I'll fix his clock. I might have to be in the meeting, but I'm not going to listen." Couple here tonight doing that, you know? And I don't know what you do when you're sitting in a meeting not wanting to be in a meeting, but I'll tell you what I was like. I was uptight like a spring, you know? And there's old-timers are smart. They set you here in the front row so you don't ride up, nod off, right, Cindy? And then they said weird stuff, I thought. They said to me, they said things from the podium, if you want what we have and are willing to go to any lengths to get it. And I looked this herd over and I thought, by God, I wouldn't have drank with half of these people. I mean, there's a couple here tonight I wouldn't drink with, right, Liz? I'm trapped, you know. He's got the keys. He won't give them to me. And we sit in the front row. I got to do something to pass the time. I don't want anything. I'm not going to listen. So I had to do something to pass the time. So I started staring around the room counting light bulbs. I mean, I would have had a blast in here. And then I run out of light bulbs. And then I start winking at girls. And then I run out of girls. And there's time left to meet, and Jesus, I'm ready to go nuts, you know. And I spot this guy about halfway back, and he's scribbling on a piece of paper. I didn't know you had to take notes here. And I watch him like a hawk. Halfway through the meeting, he gets up where he's sitting, walked around like that, went over to the door. There was a bulletin board right by the door, took a piece of paper he was writing on, stuck it on the bulletin board, and split. I didn't know you could do that. And I'm an ex-cop, and I'm nosy by nature. And I have to find out what's on that piece of paper, right? And I sneak over there to the bulletin board. Don't tell me there's no miracles. You know what was on that piece of paper? It was a little poem about drunks. And I read it, and it made sense. And when nobody was looking, I stole it. Took it along home, and on the days when I was absolutely certain that I just can't make this thing, you know, it might be all right for you guys, but I can't make it. And yet, I didn't want to go back out there in them damn cold cars and start drinking rot-gut wine again and die like my buddy Pete. So I get it out of my billfold, read it, save my can a million times. And I think it's about time for me to get down. It's a little poem entitled Which Place? I dreamed one night I passed away and left this world behind. Started down that lonesome trail some of my friends to find. Came to a signboard on the trail, directions it did tell. Keep right to go to heaven, turn left to go to hell. I hadn't been too good on earth, just a hopeless, boozing rake. I knew there at the crossroads the path I'd have to take. So I started on the rocky path that leads to Satan's place, and shook within not knowing just what I'd have to face. Old Satan met me at the gate, what's your name, my friend? I said, I'm just old sober Sam that's come to a sad end. He glanced through some files, you made a mistake, I fear. You're listed as an alcoholic. We don't want you here. I said, I'm looking for my friends. And a smile stole over his face. If your friends are alcoholic, they're in the other place. So I went back the other way till the crossroads I did see and turned right to heaven, as happy as could be. St. Peter smiled and said, come in. For you, I have a berth. You're an alcoholic. You've been through hell on earth. I saw old Dub and old Pete too. Bill C and a friend called Bell. And brother, I was tickled because I thought they'd gone to hell. So brothers, I'll take warning. Learn something from my trip. You've got a place in heaven if you try hard not to slip. If someone tempts you with a drink when you're not feeling well, just tell him you're going to heaven and he can go to hell. Thank you.
Thanks for listening. I hope you enjoyed the podcast. Sobercast is ad-free, and we'd like your help in order to keep it that way. So if you'd like to help us be self-supporting by pledging a dollar or two a month, visit Sobercast.com and look for the donate links. Thank you very much.